Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sadia Hartman, author of Scenes of Subjection, Terror, Slavery, and Self-Making in 19th Century America, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route, and Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women, and Queer Radicals. It's a great pleasure and honor to welcome Sadia Hartman to The Reading Life. Sadia is the university professor at Columbia University, and she received a MacArthur Fellowship in 2019. She is the author of Scenes of Subjection, Terror, Slavery, and Self-Making in 19th Century America, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route, and Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women, and Queer Radicals. How I love that title. Sadia is coming to Xavier University in March to present a lecture, Critical Fabulation and the Tense of History. Sadia Hartman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I was especially excited to meet you because, honestly, so many writers I admire, and fiction writers, a lot of them, have mentioned how much your work has inspired them.
That's great to hear, because while I'm a scholar, I always say that I try to write with the beauty of a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means a great deal to me that novelists and poets and artists have really engaged the work and have felt motivated by it.
Now, it's such an inspiration to read your book. Your great and important subject is the afterlife of slavery. And I'm curious about, what was the origin of this line of inquiry for you? Because so many people come to it through a family connection or a bit of family history. And what has kept you there at this important work?
For me, it too came as a bit of family history. It was my great-grandfather, Moses Thomas, who, I guess when I was about 11 or 12, began to tell me the history of my family, my maternal line, in slavery. And I was fascinated by the stories, and I would go in summers, I would go to Montgomery, Alabama, I would visit my grandmother, I would visit my great-grandfather, and in essence, he would take us on a pilgrimage through the outskirts of Montgomery, and he would point out all of the farmland that used to be owned by Black farmers that had been taken over by agribusiness. So he would tell me stories about how people lost their property. And really, my great-grandfather was the one who sparked my interest in these stories of slavery and who really made me feel an immediate and direct connection with that history, that it wasn't long ago, that it wasn't dry or abstract, that it was immediate and personal, and that it had shaped his life and his mother's life. And I think he wanted me to feel my direct connection to it.
Now, you've drawn in the details of the background of slavery, of the daily realities and insults to the spirit. And you've done this in a way that has developed your distinctive approach. So tell me a bit about critical fabulation, which is in the title of your lecture. It's a term you've coined. And talk about what it means for history and for writing, too.
Yes. I mean, I think that critical fabulation was a method that really, you know, we understand what we have done in retrospect. Mm-hmm. So it was really in trying to account for what I had done in Lose Your Mother, which is a book about a journey along a slave route in West Africa from, you know, the West African interior to the coast, that I was really confronted with the dearth and silence of the archive, although, you know, millions of Africans, a kind of conservative estimate is that 13 million Africans crossed the Atlantic Ocean, but there are only a handful of slave narratives written by those captives. And I was, you know, involved in this search for the stories, those people who had been seized from their homeland, who left the continent of their birth, and who were then, you know, transformed in this transatlantic passage. And there was so little information. And I came upon a case about a young African woman captive, and I came upon her story in the British parliamentary debate about ending the slave trade. And while there were three or four different versions of this, of the case, there were only six words about this young African captive. And I thought, I want to tell her story, but how could I possibly tell her story from a handful of words? And because I'm trained as a scholar, because I'm a cultural historian and not a novelist, I couldn't invent something whole cloth. So for me, I've always done archival research and then pushed at the boundaries of what could be said with that archive. And so what that has meant, sometime in my critical fabulation, it has meant telling the story from the vantage of many different people. So in Lose Your Mother, there's a chapter, you know, called The Dead Book, where I basically narrate what happened on board the slave ship from the perspective of all of the actors who were involved in it, the ship's captain, the doctor, the ship's hand, this young woman, a friend, the other captives that were aboard the ship. And basically, I tried to build out a story from these mere shreds of evidence, but that story was based upon lots of historical research and the experience of other lives that I encountered in the archives.
I'm curious, when you write a scene like that, because I remember that and it was so vivid, do you see that unfolding in your head as you write it?
I definitely see it unfolding in my head as I write it. And I think, especially when I'm trying to tell a story, so what do I have to work with? And so often, you know, imagining the physical space of the ship, what did it smell like? What did it sound like? We know that this young woman starved herself for over a month. So I read all of these studies on starvation and what happens when you haven't eaten, you know, the hallucinations that result from starvation. And she was also suspended from a rope upside down. And I remember talking with a friend who's a doctor and just asking her literally, so what happens to your limb when a rope is holding your arm, when it's holding your leg? And so building from that very physical and embodied experience, and I think that I create in a way that others have described as cinematic. And I think in a way it is, you know, cinematic, because I'm trying to animate this scene and I'm also trying to look at it from different perspectives on board the ship. So yeah, so the details of it are very critical to building story.
It's so rare that something can be so visual and so linguistically satisfying at the same time, because
thank you for that.
You have such rhythm in your language, such rises and falls and urgency. You know, you feel like you are there as this is happening when you read that passage, which I find an amazing gift to a reader.
I think that for me, I mean, I want the reader to feel exactly there. I want the reader to, you know, to be pulled into that scene and to feel its import, to feel that there's not some solid wall separating us from something that we call the past, but it's kind of living in the environment with us. So yes, I'm glad that you felt touched by it, that you were moved by it, that you could see it
You have said that much of your job is interrogating the archive. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that, because to me, archives are such rich and wonderful places, and they're always filled with the possibility of serendipity, of finding just the unexpected thing you need, but you didn't even know you were looking for.
And clearly, I have that relationship to the archive, too, because otherwise, why would I spend years of my life wading through documents? And I think that you do have, you know, that surprise, that encounter, which feels so dramatic, right? It takes hold of you. You know, how do you move forward with this? I mean, in Wayward Lives, I tell the story of a young woman, Maddie Jackson. And I, the first time I read her case file, I knew I was going to write about her. I was so taken with everything inside that file. And you're right, there are small things, things that are a disciplinary record that says punish for hiding stationery and a pencil in her room, punished for hiding a bar of soap in her room. That tells me a lot about who she is. And I think that there is that possibility of encountering a document, encountering a photograph, and telling a radically different story. And I think that there's a critical interrogation, and then there's also something like a love of the document, too. They're both those things, right? Mm-hmm. Even when there's a kind of disbelief, or when you accept the messiness of the archives inside, like, the legal cases of the young woman I write about, there were five different accounts of what happened. So it's not that you could read the case file and know, this happened and that happened. It was like, oh, there are these contending accounts. And so what is the story to be told from these contending accounts? And I think, you know, in writing about these young women, I mean, often they had, you know, contradictory feelings about their experiences and what they had done. Oh, I regretted it. I wouldn't do it again. Oh, I enjoyed it. So just wanting to hold that very complex truth that was there. And, you know, what are the things that you decide to replicate? In the case of Maddie, I mean, she liked pretty things and she often took pretty things from other people. And so as I'm writing this portrait of her, I think, okay, well, that's a significant detail. This is something that a number of people had commented on. And there was something that was both brazen and innocent about the things she took, because she would take, like, a bracelet from her employer, and then she would wear it to work the next day, a papered sweater. So it's not that she was, you know, I mean, it was kind of strange, right? And so, again, but for me, that's a note on character. I mean, I also write about a reformer in Philadelphia, a woman, Helen Parrish, who was, you know, very much involved in producing, creating housing for the poor. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the encounter with Helen's journals was her honesty about her constant effort to control the people that she wanted to serve, and how she often failed at that effort, what a mess she was making, how her aunt told her to stop doing that. And I just thought, what a wonderful record to leave behind.
Yes.
Again, it's kind of like the opposite of social media. So you're not always projecting your best self, but you're just talking about, oh, what does it mean to do this work? What does it mean to be a really progressive reformer and at the same time say racist things? What does it mean to be someone who wants to help and at the same time acknowledge, you know, the destructive aspects of your will to control? And again, for me, that was a document that was really incredibly rich in understanding Helen Parrish, but in also understanding the lives of these largely Black migrants to the city who she was trying to support.
Well, there's something about, you know, giving someone their full humanity, about recognizing their achievements and yet showing that they could probably irritate the living daylights out of the people they were around.
You know, I agree with you, but I think that the pressure is that often when there's so little representation about certain lives, to kind of reject a certain pressure to create these like two-dimensional, wonderful people without contradictions and failures. And I think that what attracted me to these wayward lives was precisely the transgressions, the mistakes, and the unapologetic spirit that often acknowledged those mistakes, but it wasn't the tragic end of life. Like when we think about the 19th century novel, I mean, the heroine makes a wrong move and she's destined for poverty or death, right?
Right.
And so there's something like, oh, you can make mistakes, you can fail, and then you can still continue on. And for me, that's just an incredibly important and powerful lesson.
In Wayward Lives, you bring Harlem so magnificently to life. That was such an exciting time. And you said you were rewarded by finding such beauty. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, the pleasure of that in your work.
Yes, I mean, I think that having written two books about slavery and its legacy, two other books were, you know, violence and loss were so central, it was so critical to illuminate that I wanted not to minimize that, but to say, for many people, that's the context in which life unfolds. And I think what, you know, the wonder is often like the beauty that's actually created in that context. And again, that is something that can't be denied. And in fact, it causes much anxiety for social reformers, whether it's, you know, Jane Addams or W.E.B. Boyd. It's like, you know, why are these like working class men and women spending so much of their income on really beautiful clothes, on ribbons in their hair, on shoes? And I thought again about what it means to create, what it means to fashion oneself in the context of extreme deprivation, and looking through the archive of photos, looking at the films of Oscar Michaud, that beauty, that vitality, that aesthetic edge of Harlem is undeniable, and it's so undeniable, and it's so attractive that white people start flocking en masse to Harlem to be a part of it, right? So yes, I think that to think about beauty as whether as an antidote, a modality of redress, what it is that we make in the everyday, and certainly we see that in Harlem, we see that in North Carolina, we see that in Accra, Ghana. I remember when I was in Ghana on a Fulbright, there was this huge and very notorious sprawling slum in Accra. And sewage, just the worst picture that you can imagine. And I could remember seeing a father starching the white blouse of his daughter's school uniform. And like, that's one of those moments. It's like, oh, even within this, right? There's that attention to detail, that there's that acute regard for presentation, for order, for putting the best foot forward. And often that's the only agency that one can exercise, right? And I just wanted to attend to that, especially in, you know, the context of historical and social periods where so little seems possible. You know, there are historical moments that seem like everyone knows like a radical transformation is unfolding, and there are others where it just seems like things are never going to change, and things are always going to be as awful and as miserable as they are now. And how do we live that? So I think that was what obsessed me with Wayward Lives, how people hold on, how people make beauty, how people step off an expected or overdetermined path because they want more or they want better.
And also how they pursue pleasure for its own sake, which must have been a great relief to write about.
Exactly. And it's really funny about the where politics meets this, because a lot of, you know, socialists and Black socialists, in fact, noted this when they spoke about the space of the cabaret. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, oh, you know, the cabaret is the most democratic and socially and racially integrated space in the U.S. And that, and again, there's no political agenda of the cabaret. That's where you go, you dance, you have drinks, you have mm-hmm. fun. So even, you know, kind of like recognizing that there's a kind of utopian aspiration that resides in the domain of pleasure. And again, I wanted to underscore that. I wanted to show what a kind of what a widespread feeling that was and how threatening that was to many people.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious if it was a pleasure for you to write something that's coming closer to the present, moving forward through history with that book.
And I think what was very important about that, I mean, it was like kind of thinking about my grandmother and her life, and just also meeting people who said, like, oh, it makes me understand my mother and grandmother's generation. And I actually had, it was a kind of this wonderful accident of like a woman who I wrote about in the book, her granddaughter reaching out to me after reading Wayward Lives. And for her, she said, you know, there was always in my family so much shame about who my grandmother was. And my mother, in response to like, you know, her wayward mother was totally, you know, straight, narrow, almost puritanical. She said, we never spoke about my grandmother. Her life was shrouded in a kind of shame. So to see this portrait of her grandmother that acknowledges, again, all the waywardness, all of the transgressions, but written about with a tenderness, with a respect, it was really, really important for her. So that's the gift kind of, you know, every writer wants, that, you know, you set out to honor people and to honor their lives. So to have someone say, oh, wow, this is my grandmother. Thank you for how you attended to her life. It meant a great deal for me.
Well, writing about the afterlife of slavery is work that exacts a great personal price. And I would think that that's part of the reward of doing it and the fuel to keep doing it.
You know, I would say yes. And writing Lose Your Mother was really difficult. Mm-hmm. It was really difficult to visit a slave dungeon 50 times.
Yeah.
It was really difficult to deal with, on one hand, the kind of the obliteration of all of the names, the lives, the history of these people who passed through these kind of like West African coastal portals onto the slave ship. But I think that the reward for me, and I, in the essay, Venus in Two Acts, where I actually use the term critical fabulation for describing my process, I talk about the redress of narrative and the importance of telling stories. And I think that it always feels like a gift to me when I feel like, oh, I've actually been able to discover something and to be able to share it, to write it, to find language for it in a way that I think is meaningful, in a way that is persuasive for me, and then to have others say, oh, yes, absolutely so. But I'm certainly moving forward in time in my work, and I'm currently working on another 20th century project. And I think that that movement also forward has to do with the archive. When you're talking about the transatlantic slave trade, you're talking, besides the papers that describe the business of slave trading, you're talking about an archive in which the people who experience the trade themselves are largely silent. For me, there's a pleasure of a kind of archival plentitude where I can actually read the journals and letters of people I'm thinking about, where I can see photos, where I am able to utilize a much richer range of documents in, you know, constructing your experience and this moment in time.
We've been talking with the great scholar Sudhia Hartman, whose most recent book is Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments. You can meet her when she presents a lecture, Critical Fabulation and the Tense of History, Tuesday, March 18th at 6 at Xavier University's Cutter Auditorium. Sudhia, thank you so much for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. E.B. Subway appears in conversation with Desiree Evans and signs her new novel, Skin, Saturday, February 22nd from 2 to 4 at Baldwin & Company. Kayla Min Andrews and Mona Lisa Saloy read from their work Saturday, February 22nd from 2 to 4 at The Three Muses. Christopher Roma Guerra MCs. Mike Miley, author of a new book titled David Lynch's American Dreamscape, will discuss David Lynch's films, answer questions, and sign copies of that book Sunday, February 23rd at 2 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Poets Benjamin Morris, Sky Jackson, Nikki Ummel, and Rodrigo Toscano appear at the book launch of Morris's The Singing River, Tuesday, February 25th at 7 at Blue Cypress Books on Oak Street. Today's guest, scholar Sadia Hartman, author of Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, presents a lecture, Critical Fabulation and the Tense of History, Tuesday, March 18th at 6 at Xavier University's Cutter Auditorium. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.